Are you a scaling SaaS founder?
Ready to make the leap from leading a team to leading an organization? Join us each week as we refill your think tank with actionable tips and strategies from great business minds you know and those you don't know yet. This is SaaS Fuel with your host, five-time entrepreneur, SaaS founder, and globetrotting adventurer, Jeff Mains.
Welcome back to the SaaS Fuel podcast, where we turbocharge SaaS like a sports car on the Autobahn. No speed limits, just pure, unencumbered acceleration. I'm your host, Jeff Mains. I help B2B SaaS founders like you grow from traction to scale. Here, growth is more than just numbers. It's about crafting a future-proof company, premium valuation, and leaders who build a business of significance while living epic, adventurous lives. There are lots of experiences that shape us as leaders. Some we look back on and we know we could have done better. Some we look back and are confident that we made a good decision. And some we look back on and know that a certain decision was a big growth moment. I've had a lot of all three of those. My favorite are looking back at growth decisions. You know, the crazy thing is often it's only in retrospect. In the moment, we usually don't know how important a decision it is, or this is a pivotal moment. You know, looking back, we see two very different paths, kind of like sliding doors. You know, we step through one or the other, and life would be radically different. Now, I'll never forget the sleepless nights before I had to make one of the toughest decisions of my career. And that was letting go of someone who just wasn't a culture fit, but was really talented and a high performer. And as leaders, we all face gut-wrenching choices from time to time. I mean, how do you make the hard calls while staying true to your core values? Well, here are three ways that I look at it. Number one is to get really clear on principles. In murky waters, a strong moral compass steers you right. Before being tested, define the core values and greater purpose that guide your leadership. You know, what are your ethical boundaries? What are the things that absolutely cannot be compromised? What are the things that are really just core, absolute core to your essence? There's a company called Unilever, a big consumer products company. They had a CEO named Paul Polman, and he had an unwavering commitment to sustainability and social responsibility. And through that, made some bold moves, some pretty big decisions. Some of them a little bit controversial, but stood the test of time. I think it's important that we know, you know, where we stand and that we're able to make those decisions and feel really good about them, no matter what the critics say. Defining your North Star provides clarity when you need it the absolute most. And the second is to consider stakeholders, all the stakeholders. You know, a decision that serves one group while harming another is flawed. Take time to map out all of those impacted, from team to customers to community. And as a rule, I try to aim for the greatest good. It's not always obvious at first glance. Sometimes there are trade-offs. You know, for example, made in the USA. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means higher costs and higher prices, but it means jobs at home. You know, is that a commitment that you have? You know, one business may be different than another, but it's not a zero-sum game where one wins and one loses. Keep all stakeholders in mind and explore creative solutions. Constraints create creativity. And number three is to communicate with courage and empathy. And no matter how sound the decision or how much it makes sense, at least to you and me, right? How you deliver it matters. It absolutely matters. You know, what's helped me more than anything is just being transparent about the process and thoughtful about those impacted. You know, sometimes we have to make decisions that are going to impact people negatively, but how that's communicated is absolutely critical. You know, some right decisions are wildly unpopular. It's just the way that it is, but have the courage to be vulnerable and humane. You probably remember all the tech layoffs in 22 and 23, and I guess ongoing today. You know, handled a lot of different ways. Some were mass layoffs on a Zoom call, terrible communication strategy. And others communicated bad news in a much better way. After reluctantly cutting jobs, Airbnb CEO apologized publicly to employees and investors for not meeting their expectations. You know, good leaders own the human side of hard calls. With core values as your compass, the bigger picture in view, and care for those affected, you can make the difficult choices that growth demands, and you'll grow yourself through that process as well. Stay the course and know that the sleepless nights that mean you're leading with heart. And that person who was a bad culture fit that I had to let go, hard, hard conversation. We parted ways and are still friends to this day. He left, started a company of his own, and is doing very well. It was absolutely the right call. When that happened, the team flourished, stepped up, and it was really pretty amazing. Absolutely the right call for culture, but it was extremely, extremely difficult in the moment. So what's a hard decision that you had to make? Let me know in the comments what happened. Our expert last week was Ryan Staley, founder and CEO of Whale Boss. We talked about sales, marketing, AI, and exactly what works today and why, plus where not to use AI. Great, great insights on how to turn every sales rep into a one-person army. And our founder last Tuesday was Derek Osgood, founder and CEO of Ignition, a collaborative go-to-market platform that accelerates product launches for marketing and product teams. Derek has launched over 100 products that are doing $1 billion+ in revenue. Great insights for irresistible marketing about building what sells and selling what you built. My guest today is Roland Seeblink, a 3-time tech founder on a mission to guide startups from mere product market fit to absolute market dominance. With an impressive track record of elevating 3 companies to unicorn status, welcome a guy who will help you get your tech company on the fast track, Roland Seeblink. Hey, Roland, welcome to SaaS Fuel.
Hello, Jeff. Nice to meet you. It's so great to be on your podcast. It's been a long wait, and I'm really excited.
I am as well. So you're a 3-time tech founder.
I am.
And a few unicorns in there. I mean, somebody might even say, like, unicorn breeder, maybe.
I must object to the breeder, but you know, the journey is interesting nonetheless. So yeah, I've been very lucky to be part of 3 companies that became unicorns in my career. Every time it was a company that I joined when it was under 10 people, and it typically grew over 1,000 people in a matter of 3 years. So I've really been through that journey.
Wow.
And I've also founded some of my own startups. Those were not necessarily the same companies. So, you know, there's some failures under the belt there as well, in all honesty and openness. But I think that's an entrepreneurial journey as well. Not everything is always a success, and you have to be able to pick when to pull back and launch a new adventure. But yeah, coming back to the unicorns, right. I think it's really like seeing the development of a company in fast forward. I remember at my first scale up in those 4 years that I was there, we had 5 CEOs, we had 7 strategies. You know, I don't know how many go-to-market initiatives that we had, how many products, how many pivots. And that was actually like a story I kept seeing again and again at other companies. And I also found myself, interestingly, ever drawn into some kind of advisory or coaching role for the founder CEO. Even when I was still pretty young in my career, I happened to become a chief of staff to them, and, you know, later on more like a coach. And I found that that position is just so lonely, and how difficult it is to be responsible for everything without really knowing how to do things. And so now that I've seen the journey a few times and I predict what's going to happen, I love advising and helping founders that are going through that unicorn journey right now.
That's really, really good. So what about obstacles? You know, you said, I mean, that's pretty crazy just thinking about how many CEOs and go-to-markets and things like that. You know, tell me about, you know, some of the biggest obstacles and how you overcame those, whether in the unicorns or in the companies that maybe didn't do as well.
Exactly. So I think one gigantic pivot that every founder needs to go through is from this kind of inventor mindset of developing a product that could possibly be a hit into building a go-to-market machine. and especially the VC-funded tech companies that I often work with, you know, they go and raise money and that's amazing. You get cash flow before you've really earned it, let's say, but they don't always realize the quid pro quo is now you're building a growth machine and you can't just be doing whatever you please. You've essentially closed a contract with the devil, right? And you better deliver. And that is,
what sets the successful founders apart from those who struggle to make that shift?
I think the successful founders in their mindset, they have this very rare combination of, on the one hand, being quite stubborn about their vision, but on the other hand, being very flexible about its implementation. And that's a rare combination of, you know, keeping two opposing ideas in your brain at the same time. I think that's often a marker of enough mental agility, let's say, that not everyone has. But I think it's so important to have both that stubbornness around the vision, around the big picture, as well as then the flexibility around how it gets implemented in order to really scale your vision into things that other people can execute and you know, adapt to the market as well.
And that makes a lot of sense, because when you're building a growth machine, you have to have other people that can execute. Mm-hmm. You can't do it all. And especially as it continues to grow, that becomes more and more true.
And that is probably the second biggest point that I would also highlight in terms of what are the obstacles. You know, it is to realize that as a founder, you cannot do everything yourself. And most founders I talk to in the beginning of when we start working with them, they'll constantly say, well, I can do this better and I can do that better. And sometimes it almost sounds a little bit childish, right? Because it really isn't about what can you do better. I mean, you're already amazing. You're a founder. But the question is your time best spent on this?
It's a really, really powerful question. And I think a lot of times we think that we're better, but we can't be experts at everything. And when we let those things go and let people who really are experts, even though that, you know, what we think is better is just different, that it really runs a lot truly better when somebody is an expert in that area, and especially if it's an area that maybe we can do but aren't necessarily super gifted, or that's not our superpower.
That is true. And the other point I would also make, Jeff, is that there's actually very few things in a startup, or in any company for that matter, that you need to do very well, you know? And I had a discussion with one of the co-founders of a company I'm coaching in Singapore the other day, where I said, you know, in the large majority of cases, you have to strive for just good enough. A 6 out of 10, or what is it in the American grading system, a D or a C out of the A scale, right? is actually all you need, right? And, you know, if you were to strive for an A everywhere as you do in academics, then actually that'll mean absolute failure for your company, because trying to get to excellence everywhere will actually for sure make you fail.
That's really good advice. And it's hard to do, because I think, you know, a lot of us are founders because we're high achievers. And to say that good enough is okay just really goes against our nature.
It is, but I mean, think of it, like I'd usually give an example like, okay, how good should payroll be? You know, just to take a very simple example of it is something every company needs to get done and needs to get right, but how good should it be? I mean, are you doing better if you pay like 5 days early? In mind of the employees for sure, but does it really matter? Is it a competitive advantage? No, it's actually an economical disadvantage, right? So it's the classical example of, okay, you better get it out on time, but that's all you need. Not a day early. So as long as it's correct and it's on time, that's fine, right? That's good enough. Yep. No points, no extra points for, like, you know, providing more detail, or, you know, getting it out extra early, or providing some people with faster payroll than others. All that those entrepreneurial ideas we could think about if we really brainstormed about it. There's no point.
Sure.
And the same for lots of admin stuff, lots of forms, lots of, you know, legal stuff. But really also in many of the parts of your business system that you just have to do without wanting to differentiate on them. So good enough is often the best thing to strive for. And then pick your two or three things where you really want to differentiate. And those are the things where you want to strive for really great or even perfection. But that's the things you're known for. Like Volvo wouldn't skimp on safety because that's what they're known for, right?
Right.
But, you know, do they really have to be great at like gas mileage if they're already known for safety? No, they should just be good enough, right?
And that's a really, really good example. I think that really brings it home in deciding, you know, what are those things that you really want to be known for? And you know, no company is great at everything.
It can't be.
You know, if you look at, you know, Volvo versus Ferrari, they look way, way different. Yeah, gas mileage is different. It's just they're not the same thing. And the purpose may be the same to get you from point A to point B, but they're very, very different in what that perception is and where they focus their time and energy and their brand.
Absolutely. And you say the purpose may be the same, and I think you're right. But if you then hone that down on like who are your core customers, you will immediately say, but
very
they
different.
Scratch very, very different itches, right? And that's also something that I that I think is so fundamental in building that go-to-market machine that, you know, rather than trying to sell your product to just about everyone and throwing it everywhere and seeing what sticks, to learn to hone in on the customers that experience your pain the most, that are willing to pay for it, and to be able to predict like who's on your list, who is the top 10, the top 100 of customers or companies or segments that we really need to own. I always tell founders, you should get to a point where you're personally offended if one of those companies on your target list signs up with a competitor.
Oh, that's
good. It should be like that's the girl I wanted to date and now she's gone, you know?
Yeah. That's really good. So in building your companies, you know, and you said you had great successes and then some that didn't do as well. What, looking back, what are some mistakes that you see in hindsight that you go, wow, I wish I'd really done that differently?
Yeah, I think in the early stage, I think a mistake I made and I also see many founders make is to think inside out instead of outside in. And what I mean with that is inside out means I got to have the product ready. I got to have everything working before I'm able to actually launch it on the marketplace, right? Everything needs to be done, working well, you know, professional grade, maybe not perfect, but still like it should all be in working order before I can even announce it. And what I've really learned since moving to Silicon Valley is that outside in mindset of like, no, the very first thing you do is create a launch page. There's nothing behind it at all, right? But you basically just see what's my interest and what are people searching for. And that outside-in mindset is, I think, some of the most important learning for the earlier stage. I would say then there's a corollary that in the mid stage, you know, let's say once you're like 30, 40, 50 people, you're at like a few million dollars in ARR, then it starts to become a bit of a risk to keep working on the outside in and never have your simple processes, some of your quality measures, your responsibilities actually lined up because now you're hiring so many people. And if you still want to run it like a wolf pack, then I can tell you all those people will be sitting on their hands and just waiting until somebody screams at them. And otherwise, they'll go play ping pong.
Right. Yeah, that is very, very true.
I've seen that time and time again. It's the company that I think needs help the most is when you notice like the founders are running around like crazy all the time. They're working 48 hours per day, you know, never get any time to think.
Yeah.
Whereas all the people they hired are like calm and going home at 5 and, you know, all saying how great the culture is, you know, but there's actually very little in terms of deliveries or performance that they've even been asked to deliver, right?
Yeah. And I think that's true. A lot of founders struggle with balancing that growth and then maintaining that fun, energetic culture. How should they do that? And how do they make that energetic culture a high-performing culture, especially as they continue to grow?
I love how you voiced that, like how to turn that energetic culture into a high-performance culture, because I think that's really, you know, hitting the nail on the head that you you want to move away from this like early stage startup that is essentially more like an experimental lab with a lot of play going on and seeing until something sticks. But you also don't want to turn right away into a burning old behemoth, you know, where everything is driven by process and checkboxes and all that stuff. So, I mean, there's a reason why founders start companies, is because they don't want to work at a big company like that, and nobody, they don't want it. They don't want people telling them what to do. So this is why at Midstage Institute, we really developed like that handbook for the midstage, which is, it's neither working like a startup nor working like a big corporation. It's actually a very specific set of practices. And you can compare it a little bit to adolescence in our human development, right? Like, when you're an adolescent, if you still act like a child all the time, you're not going to be very successful or admired. But if you act like a fully fledged adult of like 40 or 50, it's not going to help you much either. You have to learn to act like an adolescent. And those are the things that, you know, around like learning to know who you are, learning to know what you like, still being able to experiment, but also starting to learn to land on your own feet. And for older adolescents in particular, starting to realize, yeah, dreaming is great, but you can't be everything that you have ever dreamt up. At some point in time, you have to start choosing.
Yeah. And you bring up a good point just in making that transition and bringing in process. You know, financial management is obviously very important. And what other processes, you know, should be well-defined early on? And then how does that progress over time as the company grows?
Yeah, I do think that here you really need to distinguish between, are you more still in the exploring phase or in the exploiting phase, right? So we typically make that cutoff between, you know, are you pre or post product market fit? And that means that you found some niche that loves your product, that is willing to pay for it, and that niche can still grow, right? So once you have that, I think it's important to start actually exploiting that niche and trying to dominate it as much as you can before keeping exploring into yet additional products or other niches or other segments that you could do. So assume that that exploration mindset is already said, and they've moved to like, let's exploit what we found. Then I think the most important process to get right is like, how do we actually deliver that value on a consistent basis? And what I mean with this is really like, how do product engineering, marketing, sales, and customer success, typically also finance, work together to serve all those customers in a good way, you know, in a reliable way, so that every customer that we sign up typically gets value out of our product. And that sounds quite complicated, but I really don't mean much more than just a bunch of checklists of like, okay, here is the overall process. Here are the 10 steps that make for a happy customer. Here are the roles each department plays. And now for each department, there's another 10-step checklist to do your job well. These are the 10 things you need to get done. And what is your output? So let's not try to develop like these gigantic flow charts and all these processes and trying to manage all the exceptions. This is what you hire really talented people for in a mid-stage startup. They can figure the exceptions out. But what you really have to document is like, what's the proper flow? The flow that if there's no exception, how should it actually look? Because that's something that no employee can figure out for themselves. That's what they need the leaders for. And so if your company is called Cool Company, let's say, and to come up with like, what is the Cool Company way, and just like, how do we deliver value time and time again? That's probably the most important, call it process, that you can set up. And you really don't need to go that deep in the details to deliver that value.
Yeah. And I think that happens a lot when they do go too deep in the details, it ends up in a giant notebook that nobody ever opens, and it ends up in a drawer somewhere. I mean, the operations people are really, really happy with it at the end, and then nobody uses it.
Yes, exactly. And I think this is a typical differentiation between how it works in a mid-stage context and how it works in a corporate context. In a mid-stage context, I really think it should be the leaders that write the headers of the checklist, and then the middle managers or even the frontliners who basically fill in everything, like exactly how do we do this, like go to this screen and tick that box, you know. But it should not be particular process design people who write this stuff. No, the people who work on it should own the documentation. In a corporate setting, it's, you know, you have a lot more specialization. So then you have process experts and you have people designing documentation for somewhere else. But what's the big difference, Jeff? The big difference is that in a corporate setting, you cannot rely on always having talented people. They've grown wise that in general, you know, they have lots and lots of different talents, and most of them are relatively mediocre, to be honest. And so they need to be idiot-proof in everything that they do. That's why you come up with these manuals that are like 100 pages thick, because every little thing needs to be covered for. And the mindset underneath that is that in a corporation, your big goal is to reduce risk, because you've already got your market, you've already got your franchise and all the cash coming in. Now, how do we, you know, reduce the risk of something happening to that cash, right? Very different mindset from at a mid-stage startup where your big goal is like, we need to grow revenue almost at whatever cost, right? So if there's exceptions, there's exceptions. But the main thing is keep the money flowing and keep it growing and keep the flywheel spinning faster. And that's a very different mindset for a product process, right?
Yes, yes, it is. And I hope I'm never in the place where all I have to do is manage risk. I mean, that just sounds awful. I want to make the flywheel go faster.
Well, of course. And, you know, that's why you're doing growth podcasts and growth, you know, advising of people. But I will also say, like, in those corporations, the large majority of people don't actually realize that that's their mindset and that's their goal. Not even the executives. I mean, they will often be in denial that it's all about, you know, driving growth and driving cost control. But in reality, when you ask them how much would be good growth, they'll say, oh, you know, 2% growth would be great. And then, like, you know, the economy is growing 5%. So that's actually shrinking relative to the economy. Oh, and in inflation, 10%, then, you know, I'm not even going to have that argument then, right?
Yeah, you say, you know, just stay in the same or growing a little bit is really, you know, going
exactly down. And so, you know, that mindset's very different. And that's also why I always advise against, you know, just incorporating practices that people have copied from like some big company, whether directly from a website or a manual or a business book, or whether indirectly by importing an executive from one of these companies and finding and thinking they will be successful right away. Because the whole mindset is so different and people are not aware of those differences in mindset, right? People come from, let's say, a Google or a Facebook, and everyone goes, wow, those companies have been really successful. This executive will make such a big difference. But somebody who joined Google when it was already like 50,000 people, it's going to have a very, very different experience level and a very different mindset than what you need in a startup that has 30.
Well, how about an easy decision? Picture this, your entire team aligned and unstoppable, building a future-proof business with total clarity on what success looks like for them. It's easier than you think with Champion Leadership Group. Whether growth is booming, a little flat, or you feel like your solution is the world's best-kept secret, we've got you covered. Ditch those time-sucking spreadsheets for a SaaS operating system that turbocharges your team with scorecards and KPIs and makes leading the company 10 times easier and you 20 times more effective. Add to that community of scaling founders and an on-demand access to a fractional C-suite. Pretty cool stuff. It's all designed to unlock your company's full potential, support higher valuation, and elevate you from an engaged operator to an empowered owner. Say goodbye to manual madness and hello to world-class business operations. Now is the time to upgrade from traction to scale. Learn more at championleadership.com, where leaders evolve and companies transform.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, way, way different. And how do those people grow? So you have a team at 30, and you know, how do you help them, you know, expand their skills and grow so that they're still around when you get to 100 or 1,000? Mm-hmm.
So yeah, starting with the leaders, we do believe very much that it's best for a startup if the leader can stay in place for as long as possible. The founder has a certain charisma that is usually not quite replaceable. And so I think even Silicon Valley investors have learned this now, that trying to replace the founder too soon, too early is usually only getting the company into more trouble. But the corollary is the requirements for the job change so fast that that founder has to be open and committed to learning and to changing and to becoming ever better at what the company needs. And the hardest part, and I'm very open to founders about this, is that, you know, we will often ask you to give up the very thing that made you successful in the previous phase in order to be successful in the next phase. For example, this whole like hustle mentality of like when you have 10 people in your startup and let's just bang the heads together and we'll make it work. Excellent. And if and you would never get beyond 10 people or $1 million in revenue if you hadn't had that mentality, right? But, you know, is it still effective at 50 or 100 people? Absolutely not. So by that time, the company needs something different from you and you need to be open to learning that.
I think as founders grow and you know they're experiencing things they've never experienced before. They're you know maybe feeling like a little bit outside of the norm, leads to a lot of insecurity, imposter syndrome. How do you deal with that?
So I would say different types of founders. Maybe one common type is the person who is not really aware that they even have imposter syndrome or insecurities. They're usually just not that in touch with their emotions. And so that often manifests itself as deep down really thinking they're God's gift to the world. They're the genius and everyone else should just listen to what they have to say, even if they change their mind 100 times a day and there's new things coming down the block all the time. And usually there it's a matter of gradually increasing their self-awareness and especially their effectiveness in communicating with people. So rather than, you know, having these people basically do stream of consciousness speeches and everyone saying, oh, that was great. Now we ask them like, okay, can you for a week only ask questions? Don't give any statements, only ask questions and see what lands, see what people understand. Or if you do have a speech or something, then afterwards, make some time for feedback, not just what questions do you have, but how would you summarize what I just said? What were the three most important points you take away with you? Those things. So often it's starting from like, actually, you're not making as much a connection with other people as you think. That helps to spark that drive towards self-improvement. On the other hand, there's also a large group of CEOs and founders, I would say, who are really internally suffering from imposter syndrome, right? Where of course, they try to hide it as best as they can, and they try to pitch a lot to overcome that. But I would say it's pretty normal. It is a very highly stressful job. And I think there, the recipe is almost opposite, right? It's like, how can you get more positive feedback about the job that you're doing? And they're typically starting to create more of a feedback culture that has always balanced feedback between, yeah, there are some things you could improve, but here's all the things that I really like about the job you're doing. That helps a lot. And then overcoming that imposter syndrome and starting to realize we're all just human. And like every single person has strengths and weaknesses, even me.
Yeah. Yeah. Without a doubt. Communication is so important. Especially scaling a business. I mean, things are changing constantly. Do you have specific strategies or tools you recommend for ensuring effective communication within an organization that's growing fast?
So, I mean, that is at different levels, I would say. It depends a little bit. In some companies, we would start with really the communication between the co-founders. Often by the time we help them, there's been quite some tension building up for years between co-founders. And this is almost
happens.
Yep. And it's almost making me feel like a marriage counselor sometimes, right? That's not my chosen profession.
Very much so.
Not my chosen profession at all. But I do think I'm learning from some of these folks as well, because it really is less about making things perfect and more about starting to build a bit of understanding, like where are people coming from? Why do they think this way? And ultimately embracing each other's differences while not having to, you know, jeopardize the relationship per se, right? Because I do think most people realize that just breaking up the relationship just because you feel bad about it is usually too much of a cost compared to the benefits you might get out of it. I would say if you do have the situation where the co-founders are generally well in touch with each other, then you can move to the executive team at large. You know, And there we often really start more from, like, are the goals clear? Is everyone sure what they're accountable for? Can they talk to each other about that, right? And so having that framework in place and having that open playing field helps a lot in then facilitating the communication, because it helps a lot for it to be structured around certain goals that everyone knows we need to reach. Much easier to comment a game that has set rules that everyone knows in advance than just some chaotic bunch of people running on a field with a ball that nobody knows what they're trying to do, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're in Silicon Valley and, you know, there's yeah, somewhat of a different world in the investments that happen out there. You know, companies, you know, are raising really early, some of them a little bit later. What's your take on that? And then, you know, what's the word on the street today with venture capital, private equity? What do you see and what do you
hear? Yeah, absolutely. So I would say the first thing to observe is there's a gigantic bifurcation between, are you an AI startup or are you not an AI startup? I think for AI startups, it's still definitely like a hot boom out there, probably even more than we had for the SaaS startups 2-3 years ago. And so if you have any credible play in the AI space, then there's lots of money available. And, you know, typically still what for people outside of Silicon Valley looks like completely irrational. Like, how could you invest $20 million into a company that has no product yet? Those are the kinds of companies that are still out there. But I would say for almost everything else, it's a lot more challenging these days than it was a year or two ago. And so that means that this is something that you have to be very patient with, right? So if you are lucky enough to still be early stage, then I think you can optimize a lot for, you know, how can you not go all in for growth at any cost, but maybe a bit more prudent about seeking your growth, maybe focus on one segment at a time rather than 3 or 5 or 10, as was common during the heyday, and keep your cost under control. I don't think you need to be profitable all the way, but you need to at least be projecting profit out there in 2-3 years time, you know, as an option at least. So I think generally this is also a very good time if you're early stage to get a lot of talented employees that might not have jobs otherwise, because, you know, it's not that hot a market for employees anymore in Silicon Valley at this stage. So some of the best startups in the past have exactly started during those venture capital recessions of the past. So I would really look at that as well. If you're in the more later stage and you've been surfing funding rounds from the past and gotten really high valuations, now it's going to be quite hard to match that. So some companies decide to do a down round and just, you know, bite through the sour apple and go with it. Others try to keep the cash cushion that they still have and turn it into profitability so that they never need to raise cash anymore. If you have that option, I think that's a good one. But I think generally in those cases, there's a big psychological turnaround necessary from what you happen to aspire to in the past, which is now, frankly, out of reach. And how do you still find a new mission and a new purpose that, you know, will still make you feel successful in the end? Sometimes that even involves renegotiating the cap table with your investors. Not a fun job, but I think you can usually make the case that in order to keep people motivated, you need to actually, you know, restructure it, because it's not going to work along the old lines anymore.
Yeah, that makes sense. What do you think about the role of VCs and their alignment or maybe misalignment with founders and other investors?
Yeah, so I think I would say the best literature I've read about that is this book, A Founder Versus Investor, that came out, I believe, late last year, which is really eye-opening for many people. But it actually makes the case that, you know, each have a different role to play. And it's a business relationship where some of the interests may be aligned, but a lot of them structurally are not, right? And I think you need to understand that each has just a role to play. And where things often go wrong is when people buy into that narrative of like, oh, my investor is going to be my best advisor, or my investor is going to be my best friend. I think no experienced founder will actually confirm that. Do they sometimes give you good advice? Of course they do. Can you go for a beer with them or for a dinner? Yes, of course they do. But it's still a business relationship. And in many cases, it can get actually quite, you know, you can get different objectives, different interests really clashing in a board level meeting or something like that. And you have to be aware of that. this is why I typically advise founders to not only seek advice from investors, but to really build up a broader arsenal of people who have experience, who can advise them, and who don't often need to have that same investor mindset, so who can look at it independently. And this can be a coach, this can be a mentor, this can be an advisor, sometimes consultants come into play as well. But I think it's important to have multiple voices and multiple perspectives to draw from. And sometimes it even helps to bring some of those folks into a board meeting as an observer, you know, to help you see how well you are operating in your board as a founder, and to maybe help facilitate some of the discussion there as well.
That's really, really smart. What's the biggest misconception founders have when it comes to scaling?
I think the biggest misconception when it comes to scaling is that you need to broaden everything. So, you know, now you're scaling, you're going to be targeting 10 verticals instead of 3, and you're going to be doing every geography under the sun, and you're going to be having a whole stack of 5 products instead of 1. And, you know, with people responsible for every single aspect of that. And I think that's actually in practice not a success model. What I've seen is that the paradox is that one of my founders called it, it's more like how do you build a funnel where you have lots more ideas, but how do you actually concentrate your resources on those things you do best and actually invest in fewer and fewer things, but invest very deeply in those things that work for you. And I think it's the narrowing as you scale. That's probably the biggest misconception that people just don't see naturally.
And narrowing in what way?
Narrowing in the sense that, you know, most startups will begin with like throwing their product against the wall, and maybe they have one B2B customer in 10 verticals, right? And then they try to grow all of these verticals. Whereas over time, if you want to be efficient in your go-to-market machine, you have to figure out like, well, what are the verticals that time and time again, predictably, will buy this product because they suffer a pain that is unimaginable without our product? And how do we focus on those? And how do we grandfather out the other segments that maybe we've had one or two customers in the past, but that really are too much of an uphill battle, or at least that other segment's so much easier for us? I would say, Jeff, this is even more the case with product development, where the large majority of successful founders are product people or engineering people or scientists by trade, right? And so their natural inclination, as soon as some product starts selling, they're like, oh, now I have to go develop my second product, right? And I think this is a gigantic misconception as well, because in most cases, the real job is to then move from that initial product market fit to product market dominance, right? Where, you know, from your 2 or 3 customers in a segment, how can you get all 100 of them or 1,000 of them before the competition figures out what you're doing differently? And even then, I would look at other products development probably only once you have established a pretty strong foothold where you're in the top 3 of that market already. And then you can start launching second or third products. But I would not do that so early. It just destroys a lot of focus, builds a lot of extra complexity in your business. And frankly, a startup has only one competitive advantage, and it's agility. And that agility is absolutely the enemy of any complexity you might build.
Yep. The more complexity, then that advantage goes away and you have that split focus.
That's exactly right. And I can't tell you, like in the 3 unicorns I was part of, how much time was just purely wasted in trying to make a decision match all 3 or 4 geographies, all 5 product lines, all 6 or 7 segments that they had identified, you know, because imagine that you have somebody responsible for each of those. Now you suddenly have a meeting of 15 people that needs to agree about everything, right? How agile is that?
Not at all. Yeah. I've made that mistake multiple times and thinking we've got to expand and, you know, too early, or, you know, whether it's product, whether it's geography, whether it's people, I mean, it's all across the
board. Yeah, and the best question to ask in that case is simply, what's your market share in your core, right? What's your market share in your core segment? And the large majority of founders that tell me, oh, I need to expand, I need to launch a second product, I need to launch a second geography, I'll ask you, but what's your market share in your core? And invariably, they either say, I have no idea, or they say it's certainly less than 1%. So if your market share is less than 1%, why do you need to expand into a second field? You know, fill up your own sandbox first, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And a lot of times I think they look at it and think, you know, that it must be easier somewhere else because it's really hard where they are.
That's
and then they get over and they try something else. And hey, amazingly, it's just as hard there, maybe harder.
We might call this podcast interview the five misconceptions of scaling or something like that, because that's a really big one right there. You hit the nail on the head again, Jeff. It's like thinking that just because things are hard, you need to pivot. And I think it's so wrong. Like, it is supposed to be hard and it is going to be hard. There is not a single thing in startup land that is not hard. But really, what really pays off is not pivoting all the time, but what really pays off is persisting until you know for sure this is not going to work. I've tried everything and now I need to pivot. But in most cases, everything in the founder's mind is definitely not everything in what other companies would do to win that battle. And I think especially on go-to-market, this is where the product and engineering-oriented founders often, you know, underestimate how much time and effort it actually takes to make a market work, right? It's not something that comes naturally just because you have a cool product that people will come and buy it. It's been identified 50 years ago already as the biggest flaw in marketing thinking, right? It's work. It's actually building a machine for it. It costs a lot of money, which is why if you look at big successful companies that have been doing this for a year, where did the majority of their investment go? Sales and marketing, not products, right?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, and pivoting, a lot of times I've seen, and a lot of times it's in retrospect, it's like, you know, they get 90% of the way there and it's like, oh, this is too hard. We're going to go try something else. And then they get 80% of the way there and then this is too hard. We're going to try something else. And if they had just pushed on just a little bit further, just tried two or three more small things, it would have made
it. And this is also where external advice is so important, right? Because like, I totally get it when you're the founder and you're in charge and everyone in your company is telling you that this is too hard, then it's very hard to resist that. But outside folks will often tell you like, this is normal. You're almost there. It's just a little bit more, you know, like this is what a personal trainer will do for you as well. It's like having you know you can do those two pushes more. Don't worry about it. You got it, right?
So helpful. And scaling requires a lot of tough decisions. Mm-hmm. You know, can you share an example of a difficult decision you had to make while scaling one of your ventures, how you approached it, how you think about that?
I think when you ask about difficult decisions, it's almost always about people, right? Where you find that somebody's been doing a really good job for 1 or 2 years, but then either burns out or the company needs something else altogether. And then in most cases, it's a very difficult decision to either let that person go or to let them serve in a different role, but not on the executive team anymore. I find it's almost always in all the startups we work with necessary to have some of those discussions. In most cases, we can save the person and still have them be part of the team somewhere, but just not in the board or in the executive team anymore. The other thing would be that, you know, sometimes you have to let go of the very things that made you successful. So I remember in my first scale up, we were asked to develop a separate brand for our internet service because in those times, internet was something new and untrustworthy. And so people didn't want to the main brand tainted by that. But then it became such a successful product that they wanted to actually have a joint product. And so that amazing brand we had developed, 2-3 years later, we had to ditch because it was like there was no strategic need for it anymore. So that was painful. But yeah, everyone can see the strategic rationale behind it. And then sometimes, you know, it's what people don't like about business people, that you have to make those rational decisions and just push them through, even though all your feeling screams against it.
Yeah. Those are the most difficult for sure.
Yeah. And then, you know, very, very difficult decisions are around when do you give up? And it is also part of the entrepreneurial journey to sometimes say, this truly isn't working, or we are not raising money anymore, or we are out of energy. And does it still make sense for us to continue? Very, very hard decision for you personally, but also all the people that have believed in you, invested in you in many cases, you know. And there's, I think, where not only just advisors, but also maybe some mental health support and other things can help a lot in actually getting through those difficult decisions.
Yeah. We'll wrap up with this. Yeah, if you could go back in time, give yourself one piece of advice to your younger self back when you were just starting your very first tech startup, what would that advice be?
Good question. I would probably say your network is much more important than your skill set. So I think this is something that younger people especially don't quite realize, but when I see the difference between, let's say, startups that are trying to make it in less connected cities versus very well-connected cities, let alone be in the Bay Area, you know, it makes just such a difference. I know the founders of Kong, which is now a major unicorn, right? And those were, I knew them when they were just starting out, and they were just two Italian guys that decided to do a program at Stanford, right? And I think in the end, this made all the difference for them, because at Stanford, they met everything and everyone that mattered. And as soon as they had their idea, then they could get some initial investment and they could get the advice. And over time, they've built on all of that advice and built an amazing company right here, not in Italy.
That's great. Yeah, relationships. And that I think relational capital is far more valuable than any other type of capital there is, even more than money.
That's true. And you can, and this is the other part that I want to mention, but you can actually actively manage that network. You can build it, right? It's just like money. You know, people will often be dumbfounded, but I don't have the relationships or I don't have the money. But I think you can see, like, just same way you can earn money or you can invest money and make a return. And the same way you can do that in a network as well. Like, it just takes a lot of effort and energy building on the network relationships you already have, traveling to people, going to events, you know, building step by step, building your network. And over time, you'll suddenly find yourself with, I don't know, 6,000 LinkedIn connections.
That's great. Where can people learn more about you and about Midstage Institute online?
Yeah, so we've built a landing page that helps people get all the resources in one go, which is midstage.org/thrive. And there they have my contact information. They have overview of my latest blog posts and videos. And of course, also LinkedIn connections and everything they need in order to get in touch with me.
Outstanding. Roland, great conversation. Thanks for being on SaaS Fuel.
Absolutely. This was an amazing interview. You're a great interviewer, and it was an honor to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks again, Roland, for coming on the show and sharing your insights and resources. This has been a fantastic conversation. You can learn more about the man, the myth, the legend, Roland Seeblink, and his company, Midstage Institute, at midstage.org. As always, all links, highlights, resources, and full show notes are available at sasfuel.com. And be sure to check out our YouTube channel as well. Full episodes, video shorts, training, some outtakes, pretty funny stuff. Everything is available over there for you on YouTube. So here's an idea. Share this episode with someone you've shared a memorable experience with. It's a great way to reminisce and reconnect over shared interests. And you know, everyone who shares this week gets a unicorn horn headband. It's not just high fashion. It grants you the power to turn any mundane task into a magical adventure. You know, it's what every serious tech founder is wearing around the office these days. Can you imagine? Then again, that probably makes about as much sense as some of the other fashion trends that are real. Join us Thursday on our SaaS Fuel Expert Series, where my guest is Justin Chi, founder of Cold Email Hackers. They craft B2B lead generation strategies for early stage startups. We'll be talking all about how to use email effectively. And then next Tuesday, we have founder Jason Friedman, CEO of CX Formula, like Customer Experience Formula. We'll be talking about growing and scaling businesses with stability, purpose, and energy. And you will love hearing about the kinetic customer formula. I'll see you next time. And as always, enjoy the journey.
Thanks for listening to SaaS Fuel. Full show notes for each episode, which includes a summary, key takeaways, quotes, and any resources mentioned, are available at sasfuel.com. Be sure to follow and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you're enjoying the content and getting value from these episodes, please leave us a rating and review at ratethispodcast.com/SaaSfuel. We'll be sure to read these out on future episodes.